Good evening. Welcome. Thanks to the Boston Book Festival for the opportunity to have this panel and this very important conversation today. I just want to begin by checking to see if you're all in the right place. Is there anybody in the hall who's worried about the future of the Republic? If so, raise your hand. All right, you're at the right place. We're glad you're here. Housekeeping first. The church asks no food or drink. I thought they were going to say no swearing, but they didn't specifically ask that. So we ask for dispensation and hope not to abuse it. Please kill your cell phones, if you'd be so kind. We all know we need that. And at the end of this conversation, if you would be kind enough to let our distinguished panelists make their exit to the tent just across the way, they will be very available for your tender ministrations then. But if you can let them get out before we mob the aisle, that would just be awesome. Good. So let's do it. I'm thinking about what a strange season we are in as a country, a great nation, brilliant ideals, great wealth, astounding history, the frontier nation in science and innovation, a nation that should be capable of anything required. And here we are divided and paralyzed in many ways, exactly when so much is required. Change and courage, insight, humanity, imagination, maybe recreation. These are big challenges. To address them this afternoon, I have assembled what I like to call the Avengers. Or you may say the Magnificent Five. Kind of team of superheroes to help us out against all odds, to help us figure this out. We have represented on this stage really some terrific minds focused on, well, to boil it way too far down, we've got sex, we've got money, color, and I'm boiling too far down, we're going to elaborate, we've got the market and its limits, and we've got common sense and its death. I'm going to ask each of our distinguished panelists to open with maybe 5 minutes to bring us the fruit of their particular angle of special insight. Then we're going to open the conversation up here and take it round and round, trying to get somewhere in this hour in understanding the moment that our nation, our political culture is in. Before this is all over, I hope in this wonderful, beautiful gathering gloom of Trinity Church to hold with all of you a kind of seance, asking what we need to summon from our past and what we need to summon in our future to really rise to the challenges of this century, because why shouldn't we fully, beautifully rise to the challenges of this century? On our distinguished panel today, let me introduce Michael Sandel, author of What Money Can't Buy. Randall Kennedy, author of The Persistence of the Color Line. Lawrence Lessig, author of Republic Lost. Nancy Cohen, author of Delirium, The Politics of Sex in America, and Philip Howard, author of The Death of Common Sense. I'm going to ask Larry Lessig to dive in. Larry Lessig is at Harvard Law School. He first made his mark looking at the internet and the whole realm of digital rights and freedom. He's turned his attentions to money in our politics, and he has made it, I can personally attest, a real crusade, a real commitment. I have seen him at this point in all kinds of venues. I've seen him pull up, Occupy Wall Streeters who hadn't had a bath in a while and blue-tinted ladies who care about the Republic to really quite a magnificent tenor of fervor. He is focused very deeply on what's going on with money in our politics. I'm going to give him the first whack at this moment in our political culture in the history of this great nation. Let's have a round of applause for all of our guests, and we'll put Larry right on it. Lawrence Lessig, take us away. Where are we?
So, as you said, I've spent about the last 5 years focused on what I think about as corruption. But I don't focus on illegal corruption. I focus on legal corruption. I focus on the ways in which we allow institutions to evolve so that they lose sight of their objectives. And the particular one that I focused on in this book was our political institutions and the sort of corruption that's brought about by the way money has a role in our political system and the sort of issue that cases like Citizens United brought to fore. But I was there before Citizens United, so I've been here for a very long time. Now, the issue, though, is one which it's extremely hard to get people to focus on. It's hard to get them to even understand how to think about it. Because some people say the problem is the idea that money is speech. I don't think that's the problem. I think money should be thought of as a kind of speech. Other people say the problem is corporations are persons. Well, whether or not corporations are persons, this problem persists. Some people say it's because of spending wildly too much money in our campaigns. And I think, I don't know how much money we ought to be spending in our campaigns. I don't think that's the core of the problem. I think the core of the problem is the way that we've chosen to fund elections. So right now, in this political system, the tiniest fraction of the 1% fund our elections. In 2010, 0.26% of America, one quarter of 1% of America, gave more than $200 in a congressional election. 0.05 gave the maximum amount to any congressional candidate. 0.01, the 1% of the 1%, gave $10,000 or more in an election cycle. And in this presidential cycle so far, 0.000015%, for those of you doing the numbers, you know that's 47 Americans, have given 42% of the super PAC money spent to date. 47 have given 42%. We fund our elections with the tiniest slice of the 1%. And as candidates spend between 30 and 70% of their time raising money from that tiny, tiny slice of the 1% to fund their elections, they become, as any of us would, extremely sensitive to what that tiny fraction of the 1% wants. They become shapeshifters as they constantly adjust their views in light of what the tiny fraction of the 1% wants. Leslie Byrne, a Democrat from Virginia, describes that when she went to Congress, she was told by a colleague, quote, "always lean to the green." Then to clarify, she went on, "he was not an environmentalist." Now the point is, this system has an effect. And its most dramatic effect is it leads all of us to believe money buys results in our government. Indeed, 75% of us, according to a poll I did for my book, believe money buys results in Congress. A little bit higher Democrats from the Republicans, but I guarantee you before the Republicans took control of the House, it was just as many Republicans as Democrats. So whether it's two-thirds or three-fourths, this is what we all believe. Money buys results in Congress. And as we see this explosion of money, we are increasingly frustrated by it. So in July, Gallup ran a poll. They asked Americans, what are the top issues that the next presidential campaign needs to address? And number two on that list was corruption in government. 87% of Americans said corruption in government was the issue we should focus on. And again, that's not Rob Blagojevich corruption. It's not Jack Abramoff corruption. Those issues are way in our past. The corruption we're talking about is exactly this corruption, the way we've allowed money to buy our elections. But the most striking thing about that statistic, I had a researcher go back and look at every single presidential campaign we have records for and look at the Gallup list of top issues and ask the questions, were those issues addressed by the candidates? Did they talk about them on their web pages? Did they say, these are the issues that we care to talk about and fight about? In every election, every one of those 10 issues was on the top of the list for every presidential candidate until this election. This is the first time that we can tell that an issue on that top 10 list is nowhere on the issues that either candidates are talking about, neither Obama nor Romney. Both sides want to ignore this issue because I think in a sense both sides are deeply embarrassed by this issue. So we have to find a way to force it back into the center of political debate, if we have any chance to find a way to solve it so that we can restore something of this republic.
Lawrence Lessig, thank you very much. The book is Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Thank you very much. Our next panelist, Nancy Cohen, is author, historian, teacher, civic leader, a leading voice on women and women's issues in American politics. Her expertise could not be more timely. We've all heard legitimate rape, pregnancies intended by God, even from rape. She's credited with coining the term sexual counter-revolution. She is not shy in the ambitions of her books, The Reconstruction of American Liberalism, The 1990s, A Social History of the United States, and the latest, Delirium, The Politics of Sex in America. Nancy Cohen, talk to us about our political culture now and how your area of focus informs what's going on.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thank all of you for coming today. I'm here to do the lady parts beat. So this is an election that was supposed to be about the economy, and sometime last winter, it became all about sex and women. So first, we had a panel convened by Congress about birth control that included a celibate priest but excluded all women. Around about that time, the Commonwealth of Virginia was passing a law for an mandatory ultrasounds for women seeking abortions. One of the major funders of one of the Republican candidates suggested that if gals put an aspirin between their knees, everything would be okay in America. Fast forward a few months, and the day that the healthcare reform's mandate to provide birth control free of copay, in the same way, say, your blood pressure medicine would be provided, prompted a Republican congressman to liken the day to September 11 and the attacks on Pearl Harbor and said, this is a day that will live in infamy. Of course, then you have Todd Legitimate Rape Aiken, kind of mucking up the Republican convention. And then just this past week, as Tom mentions, you have another Republican Senate candidate, Murdoch of Indiana, saying that women who are impregnated by rape, well, that was something that God intended. I mean, transvaginal ultrasounds, God playing wingman to rapists. Ladies, anyone else feeling it's getting crowded down there? So, one of the propositions in my book, perhaps if the pill had never been invented, American politics would be very different today. Now, that's the opening line of my first chapter, and when I wrote it 2 years ago, you know, I was taking literary license. I didn't realize that we'd be hopping in Dr. Brown's DeLorean for a ride back to Nathaniel Hawthorne's Boston. So happy to be here today. Anyway, so I think the question we have to ask is why? 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 How did we get here? Why are we here? That's the story I try to tell in my book, Delirium. You know, in our kind of political colloquial, partisan colloquialisms, you could call it the history behind the war on women. So I think this is a logical and predictable result of what I call the sexual counter-revolution. Essentially, back in the early 70s, a small group of people, primarily Orthodox and fundamentalists, freaked out about the sexual revolution, feminism, and gay rights. And they got politically active to turn back the clock to a time when birth control was illegal, when gay sex was legal in every state, when abortion obviously was illegal, and when it was perfectly legal to discriminate against women. Right? So I think I only want to talk for a few minutes here. There are a few surprises here. One is that this is a bipartisan phenomenon. Two is that this reaction against women's equality actually started with women, and it started over the issue of women's equality, specifically the Equal Rights Amendment, and abortion came in much later, about 7 years later. So I think this really complicates our ideas about how we understand the people I call the sexual fundamentalists who have hijacked the Republican Party. That's on the right. On the left, Interestingly, it is some of the most liberal men, liberal progressive men, who have been most ambivalent about the revolution in gender relations. And I do think if we look at this from a world historical standpoint, what America and much of the advanced world has gone through in the last 50 years in the changes in gender relations, particularly in women's roles, particularly in the openness toward toward homosexuality and being gay, that this is a really fundamental revolution in our culture, in our society, and it's no surprise that there would be a profound reaction against it, something like a counter-revolution. So I tell the story in my book about how we got from then to now. So the question is, where are we now? I think there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is that, and I say this having spent about 18 months reading just about every credible public opinion poll and social science survey of the last 40 years, that the mainstream of America is what some of us may call progressive on social issues, but it's just the middle, it's the center, it's the mainstream now. People do support women's rights, they do support equal civil rights for gay citizens. And the sexual fundamentalists are a small minority, and on some issues, such as birth control, outnumbered 9-1, on something like gay marriage, now in the minority. On abortion, I will tell you, running about 3-2 in favor of the pro-choice position that it should be a women's freedom and right to choose when and if to have children. So the good news is that the sexual fundamentalists are far less popular than they seem if you just listen to the press and assume that those making the most noise must be the most powerful. But the bad news is that they are far more politically powerful because they have been brilliant political organizers in the electoral arena over the last 40 years when, frankly, a lot of Democrats or people who consider themselves progressive have often stepped away from the electoral arena and have kind of handed the victories to the far right of the Republican Party. So, for example, in the 2010 election, 40 million people who had voted in 2008 did not vote. All right. If you want to understand why the far right Tea Party Republican Congress was elected, it was a turnout issue. It was an engagement issue. So I think the good news is, and I think something that all of us share, is that greater engagement in our democracy will end the delirium of talking about birth control and how to define rape in the year 2012. This is insane. We should not be discussing this anymore. This should not be a political issue. The bad news is that the Republican assault on women's rights, on women's equality, is real. And it is the mission of the people who most strongly identify as Republicans and who are most active in the Republican Party precinct levels and state levels. Now, I think in terms of people who identify as Republican, probably only half of people who identify as Republican actually agree with these positions. But their party has been hijacked by these people. So I do think that we are at a crossroads on these issues of women's rights, women's freedom, women's equality, women's equal pay. Obviously, we are at a crossroads on equal rights for gays, whether it's marriage or actually finally passing anti-discrimination legislation at a national level. A lot of this has to do with the Supreme Court. And so, although time is on the side of sanity, this election, a lot could be lost.
Nancy Cohen, author of Delirium, The Politics of Sex in America. Let's applaud just to stay engaged here. And because she deserves it. Thank you, Nancy.
Right?
Okay. Randall Kennedy is professor of law at Harvard Law School. Barack Obama's alma mater, of course. He's author of Race, Crime, and the Law, author of Sellout, The Politics of Racial Betrayal, most recently author of The Persistence of the Color Line, Racial Politics, and the Obama Presidency. It is a big look at how the president has handled race and how the country has handled his race. Brent Staples reviewed it for the New York Times, boiled it down to the two black, two white presidency. Randall Kennedy, your thesis and how it hits our political culture today.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here. And I'm happy to talk about the race question in our politics, but for my preliminary remarks, I'm going to go in a somewhat different direction and say that, for me, the biggest problem in our political culture right now has to do with a particular sort of voter. Journalists call this voter the low-information voter. In my view, the biggest problem that we have in our politics is the ignorance and the false consciousness of the American adult population. Every year we hear about this ignorance, the degree to which people do not know the basics of the American political system, the degree to which people are simply, it seems, incapable of sensibly coming to a decision about where their best interests lie. A few weeks ago, there was a debate. 70 million people heard the first presidential debate, and over and over and over again, one heard a journalist say, well, this was the first time that millions of people had paid any attention to the challenger. Here we have the presidency of the United States at in the balance, and it was the first time that millions of people had paid any attention. When Lawrence Lessig just spoke of very eloquently and passionately about money in politics, why is it that propaganda has such power, has such sway in our politics? It seems to me that if people were more informed, if people were more independent-minded, if people were more attuned to critical thinking, this great just ocean of political propaganda wouldn't be as powerful, wouldn't be as influential, wouldn't be as much of a political force. The various myths that wreak havoc in our political culture, myths having to do with gender relations, myths having to do with race relations, myths having to do with class relations, those myths would not wreak the havoc that they presently do if people just basically knew more. So it's that, really, the low information voter. And by the way, when I say low information voter, it's even worse than that, because the low information voter is at least voting. What about the millions beneath? Here we have the United States of America. We love to talk about our democracy, yet voter participation in our elections is at the bottom end amongst advanced industrial countries. And amongst the people who are not participants are people who are generally on the ignorant side, people who they're not just ignorant, they've been made ignorant. This didn't just happen. The condition that I'm talking about didn't just, fall out of the sky. It is a created condition. It's a created condition that is then exploited by the higher circles in our political culture. And in my view, that's the biggest problem that we confront. Thank you very much.
Randall Kennedy. Thank you, Randall. The Persistence of the Color Line is Randall's latest book. Philip K. Howard, lawyer and writer based in New York, author of The Death of Common Sense, The Collapse of the Common Good, life without lawyers. He's looked carefully at our law. He's found us bound up in the law that is supposed to facilitate the society, the political culture that we live in. Philip Howard.
Thank you. Our culture is a complex organism. It has many problems, the things that have already been talked about. Others, I think we have a lack of a shared vision. So we have two parties that present visions that bear no resemblance to either what the public believes or what they need. They're deliberately polarizing. So there are a number of things to talk about here. My particular interest in what I'm writing about is the relationship between authority and freedom and the absence of the capacity of people to make choices to dig ourselves out of the rut. And I believe this is, in part, a structural problem. We've actually organized our democracy largely in the last 50 years so that people with responsibility no longer are able to make the choices needed to make sense of those choices. It's true at every level of responsibility. So a couple of years ago, 70% of federal tax revenue was consumed in three entitlement programs that didn't even come to Congress for annual authorization. It's just on automatic pilot. These are really important programs like Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security, but we couldn't afford them, and yet no one was making choices about how perhaps we could modify those so that we don't force our children or grandchildren to pay for them. The environmental review process, very important process, has now gotten to the point that the average length of review for a major project is beyond the electoral cycle of our political leaders. It's over 8 years. I spent a half a day recently with the project manager for rebuilding the Bayonne Bridge that goes from Staten Island to Bayonne, New Jersey. It's very important to raise the roadway so that the post-Panamax ships can come in. It's environmentally important as well as good for the economy of New York. They figured out a way to do it simply by raising the roadway in the existing bridge. They wouldn't change the foundations. They wouldn't change the roadway. So that was in 2009. It's now almost 2013. They're threatening lawsuits are being threatened for shoddy environmental review for a project that, as far as I can tell, has virtually no environmental impact because they brilliantly figured out a way not to build a new bridge and not to build a new tunnel. Example of legal paralysis. Teachers in America have lost the capacity to maintain order in a classroom. This is a legal problem. It's been studied by Richard Arum at NYU, among others, about how the rise of due process has basically corroded the authority of teachers. So the students no longer believe that teachers have authority, but they don't. And as a result, kids don't get the learning they want because half the time is spent maintaining order. I could give lots of other examples. So what's happened is we have this accretion of law. Most of it for purposes that I agree with. I'm not against the law. I'm not for deregulation. That's built up like sediment in the harbor that prevents important public choices from being made needed to run a crowded society. So in a very real sense, we have a democracy run by dead people. It's people who made these deals in 1965 or another important law, special ed. I'm for special education. It has ballooned out of control. It's over 20% of the total K-12 budget now for a tiny fraction of the kids who really need it. Well, that money is not available for pre-K education, you know, and other useful programs. We can't let these programs go on automatic pilot. We have to take back the authority to run a democracy. We elect people. We want them to make choices. And we no longer have the capacity to do that. So how do we fix it? This is not just a historical or practical problem or a flight from responsibility. It is all those things. All of this is kept in place, the status quo, by what Larry Lessig was talking about. If you want to change one word of the law, one word of any of those laws, you have to run a gauntlet. A majority of Congress has to run a gauntlet of special interests beating you over the head with money. It's so improbable to change the law that nobody even thinks about doing it in Washington. But it's not just that problem. It's also a philosophical problem. We have a belief that law can pre-make correct choices. We've built a system up to guarantee that there'll never be any unfairness at any school anywhere. There'll never be any sort of favoritism by an elected official, and I'm all for those goals. But we have so much law at this point that we've actually taken away the authority of the people who supposedly have responsibility. So I believe in order to dig ourselves out of the rut, we're going to have a major historical event which includes a philosophical shift towards not deregulation, but radical simplification of the law to replace tens of thousands of pages of laws and rules with goals, principles, checks and balances, but mainly individual responsibility and accountability. You have to give people on the ground the freedom to do their jobs. That's true with the teacher, and it's true with the president. And right now, they don't have that authority. Thank you.
Philip Howard, thank you very much. Philip Howard is author of The Death of Common Sense. My questions are piling up here as we go. I'm sure yours are too. We're going to dive into all this in just a moment. Philip Howard, thank you very much. Michael Sandel is with us, political philosopher, Harvard University, one of the most popular professors on the campus for many years. His course, Justice, has been taken by thousands and thousands of students there, sometimes thousands in a single season. His new book is What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of the Markets. The New Statesman writes, in a culture mesmerized by the market, Sandel's is the indispensable voice of reason. Michael Sandel.
Thank you, Tom. Our public discourse is in bad shape, and I think the reason is that we shrink from engaging with big moral questions. And one of those big moral questions that's missing from our public discourse is the subject of the book. The question is this: what should be the role of money and markets in our society? Today, there are fewer and fewer things that money can't buy. If you're sentenced to a jail term in Santa Barbara, California, Tom, if that should ever happen to you,
I can think of worse places, Michael.
You should know that if you don't like the standard accommodations, you can buy a prison cell upgrade. You didn't know that?
No, I'll salt something away for that eventuality.
It for how much? $90 a night.
$90 a night?
Reasonable.
When I do my big crime, I'm going to Santa Barbara to do it. But I'm going to need backing from all of you at that rate.
If you want to sit in on a congressional hearing in Washington, D.C., but you don't want to stand on the long line that sometimes forms, even overnight, outside or on the block, you can go to a company. It's called linestanding.com. Mm-hmm. The company will hire a homeless person or somebody else to stand in the line for you all night if need be. You pay the company, and just before the hearing begins, you can go in and claim your seat. As I'm sure Larry knows, lobbyists avail themselves of the line standing company. In bigger areas too, war. In Iraq and Afghanistan, there were more paid military contractors on the ground than there were U.S. military troops. This isn't because we had a public debate about whether we wanted to outsource war to private companies. It just happened. Lots of things have been just happening that way over the past 3 decades. Almost without our realizing it, we've drifted from having a market economy to becoming a market society. The difference is this: a market economy is a tool, a valuable and effective tool for organizing productive activity. But a market society is a place where almost everything is up for sale. It's a way of life where market reasoning and market values reach into almost every sphere of life: health, education, the environment, citizenship. Why worry about this? Because markets are not neutral instruments. Economists often assume that markets are inert, that they do not touch or taint the goods they exchange. And this may be true if we're talking about material goods. If you sell me a flat-screen television or give me one as a gift, the flat-screen television will be the same good. It'll work just as well either way. But the same may not be true when market values and market reasoning and price tags reach into personal relations, civic life, health, education, and so on. One area where you can see how market values and the commodification of everything is corrosive is in the shape of our civic life itself. Because the more things money can buy, the fewer the public places and occasions when people from different walks of life and social backgrounds encounter one another. When I was a kid, I was always a baseball fan. I grew up in the Midwest, in Minnesota, and I went to see the Minnesota Twins play. Now, there were always the more expensive box seats and the bleacher seats. But when I was a kid, do you know what the difference, those of you who can think back to the mid-60s, what the difference was between the most expensive box seat and the cheapest seat in the place?
$20.
It was $3.50 for a box seat and $1 for the bleachers.
$2, okay.
The effect
I've been commodified.
The effect of this, it's easy to forget what it was like. The effect is when you went to a baseball game, it was a place where CEOs and mailroom clerks sat more or less side by side. Everybody ate the same soggy hot dogs. Everyone waited on the same long line for the restrooms. And when it rained, everyone got wet. But today, that is no longer true. Almost every major sports stadium in the country now has skyboxes, which means that the privileged and the affluent get to sit upstairs in the air-conditioned comfort, eating fancy food, with short lines for the restroom, far above the common folk in the stands below. And when it rains, it's no longer true that everyone gets wet. Now, this wouldn't matter by itself. It's not the most morally grievous fact about our society, except that something similar is happening throughout American life. At a time of rising inequality, the marketization of everything means that people of affluence and people of modest means lead increasingly separate lives. We live and work and shop and play in different places. Our children go to different schools. You might call it the skyboxification of American life. It's not good for democracy. And it's not a satisfying way to live, even for those of us who sometimes are privileged enough to sit in the skyboxes. And here's why. Democracy doesn't require perfect equality, but it does require that men and women from different social backgrounds, different walks of life, encounter one another, bump up against one another in the course of everyday life. Because this is how we learn to negotiate and abide our differences, and this is how we learn to come to care for the common good. And so the question of markets is not really ultimately an economic question. It's a question of how we want to live together. Do we want a world where everything is up for sale, or are there certain moral and civic goods that markets do not honor and money cannot buy? Thank you very much.
Michael Sandel, thank you very much. Thank you. Michael Sandel, author of What Money Cannot Buy. All right, so we've got the basic thesis out here. Randall, I'm glad you went off in this direction. There's a lot to pick up on right there. Let's dive in on this. And I've got questions for all of you, and I'm sure the audience does too. We're not going to pass the mic around, but I'm going to try and channel. Larry, first to you.
In all of this, we look at our political culture, we've had sort of five angles here on how dire its problems are. When you look at this and you're talking about it every day, what is at stake and how close are we to losing the essential efficacy of our democracy that we all assume that it all works upon?
Yeah, so, you know, when Randy talks about the ignorant, I guess I wonder, why are they ignorant? You know, because these very same people you talk about as ignorant, I listen to them talking about baseball, and I don't have a clue what they're talking about, because they know a million times what I know about baseball, because they're so passionately devoted to understanding it, they understand everything there is to understand. But when they talk about politics, they're ignorant. Why? And I think they are rationally ignorant. Why waste your time as an ordinary American understanding anything about this government when it's the tiniest fraction of the 1% who call the shots? Why waste your time? So we are ignorant, of course. Ordinary Americans are ignorant because it doesn't pay to be anything else. And the hardest challenge here is, what do? To convince people that they have to be irrational for a short period of time to reclaim this thing we think of as our republic, because if we don't, I think it's, you know, all of us are saying essentially, it's catastrophic, right? There isn't a single important issue that we face, whether it's global warming or the debt, whether it's healthcare or financial reform, whether it's the environment, there isn't a single issue that we are going to address rationally until we fix the system. We are not going to get global warming legislation ever until we fix the system. And so finding a way to teach us to be irrational enough to pay attention to this issue so we're not ignorant and we can reclaim it is, I think, the biggest challenge.
Rational ignorance, you're saying. Now, you've got a plan. You want to try and change the way we do things by constitutional convention to change the way we finance politics in this country. And you're saying that would take a leap of kind of almost irrational faith that we can do this to get it done. Describe what you want to see done.
Well, the only way we fix it, you know, we're going to have congressmen and senators and presidents who are dependent upon their funders from here until time immemorial. So the only way to fix it is to make it so all of us are the funders, not just the tiniest fraction of the 1%. Mm-hmm. So we need to begin to talk openly about something that no politician will even whisper. We have to have publicly funded public elections. It's the only way.
And you want to give, is it $50, $100 to every citizen?
Yeah, I think every citizen, just for Congress, every citizen should have a voucher, $50 voucher. First $50 they send to the federal government sends back in the form of a voucher.
For them to apply towards some campaign.
Give it to any campaign that agrees they're going to fund themselves only with vouchers plus $100 in contributions from any individual.
And you want this in the U.S. Constitution?
I'll take the Constitution, but I'll take a law. I'll take anything at this point, right? I just want it to happen, right? And if we did that, when Congress people were dependent upon their funders, they would be dependent upon a wide swath of us, not just the tiniest fraction of the 1%.
And that would be a way, but it's going to take a kind of irrational, at this point, because the rational thing they're up against is all that money and all its influence.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you excite that irrational leap, that rush to do this before this catastrophic potential future that you and everybody kind of alludes to? How do you excite that?
Yeah, I think you excite it by exciting more people to be in the business of teaching their neighbors, talking to their friends. You know, we have a group called Root Strikers.
With Joe Trippi and more.
Yeah, so this is Henry David Thoreau. For every 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil, there's one striking at the root. So we want to recruit, if there are for every 1,000 in America, we need 300,000 teachers to help educate other people about how this root cause is making it impossible for us to deal with any of the issues that we want. And once we can get people to begin to convince other people, that's the way it begins to bubble up. Because what we've seen in this election in particular is the politicians are not going to talk about this and not going to address it. And until we find a way to force them to, we're never going to get it addressed.
Randall Kennedy, here we are, 200-plus years, and for most of that time, we had the sense that slowly and painfully and sometimes bloodily, we were improving our democracy. Now here we are in 2012, and you say we've got this sort of endemic ignorance, almost, maybe it's a willful ignorance, maybe it's a rational ignorance. And it comes at the very same time as you've got other rising powers in the world who are not committed to democracy. Where's your faith in democracy? If this is what we've got after 200 plus years, are you checking out? Did the age of reason sort of leave us with an illusion?
No. I meant to speak critically because I think that we are in a real pickle and there's much to be critical about. At the same time, one always has to ask the question, compared to what? So I don't want to sound like a declinist and get nostalgic. If we ask, how does our democracy compare to what, 1900, 1920?
But
1950.
Progress was the point. We had a sense of progress.
Yes,
at that point,
and
as compared to what, regression or what?
No,
going
and
on?
What I'm saying is, in certain ways there has been progress. I mean, after all, we are still in an America that is experiencing a quite remarkable moment. The most important single political figure in the United States is a black man. Now, for most of American history, that was absolutely inconceivable. Now, a lot has gone into that, and frankly, a lot has gone into that about which Americans can justly be proud. So I don't want to say that, we're going backwards, backwards, backwards.
Ignorance, false consciousness of the voter, incapable of sensibly sorting out where their best interests
lie. Both of those things are true. And in fact, in the earlier comments, I made it seem as though the 47% comment, to get back to Michael Sandel's a point.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is, our politicians of various sorts, when they vilify the poor, when they talk about people being lazy, when they talk about people not trying to take responsibility for themselves, sometimes they're not being malevolent. They're just being ignorant. They don't know these people. They don't know how their fellow Americans are up against it and are working two and three jobs. That itself is a type of ignorance, and it's a type of ignorance that has real political consequences. So we do have major challenges confronting us. At the same time, at the end of the day, we have major problems confronting us. At the same time, we also have important sources of strength that we ought not forget and that we ought to try to tap.
Lawrence Lessig says we've never seen a bought and paid for system quite like this before. Is it rational ignorance then? Why should I go and worry myself with all this when the 0.00015% sounds like a zip code is going to run it all?
We have seen change happen in the United States. I mean, if one takes a look at the 70 years or 100 years, let's take a look at 100 years, has there been significant change? Remarkable change in terms of the enlargement of the electorate, in terms of new possibilities. We have seen the emergence of new possibilities if, and this is a big if we work together through concerted, intelligent action, we do have a democracy that is capable of bettering itself.
It's a big if it's short-circuited. Nancy Cohen, let me come to you on gender issues and sexuality issues. We know how deep in the human psyche they run, and you write about this. And we know we've seen major changes in our culture around women, around gay rights and gay marriage, just in a very small number of decades. These illicit, and you describe this, very potent, deep, powerful responses. So could our whole democratic project founder on this? Could we sink the whole ship of what we've been up to on sexual politics? Is it that potent?
It's not that potent anymore because enough people have changed. So
really? Those margins you described, okay. You say it's gone mainstream, so, but the mainstream's the tail's wagging the dog here.
So when I was first researching this book and looking at the 70s and looking at some of the things we said, I think my favorite quote from a Democrat, from George Meany, who was the head of the AFL-CIO, in 1972, did not support George McGovern for president. It was the first time since the New Deal that that organized labor has not supported the Democratic candidate. And he said to a group of steelworkers shortly after he went golfing with Nixon, "The Democratic Party has been taken over by abortionists, boys who want to marry boys, girls who want to marry girls, and Jacks who look like Jills and smell like Johns." So
okay.
and if you look at polling of people over 70, like Meany was at that time, 3/4 of women over 70 believed that a woman's place was in the home in 1972. All right, so there was a really widespread, legitimate cultural reaction against these changes in the early years. What I see today, and I might be wrong, but I think the evidence supports me, is that
I'm interested how you define legitimate. I mean, there was a lot of reaction to the end of slavery, too. Was that legitimate? I don't know.
Let's leave that aside. I take back the legitimate. What I say is it was widespread among, for example, it was widespread among liberals who believed in equality in every other sphere, but had a real problem with women's equality.
You keep going on about liberals who have a problem with it, but that's not where I noticed people willing to sort of tear down the cathedral.
What I see today from the public opinion polling is that the opposition to equal rights for gays, the opposition to actually women's equality, not just women's reproductive rights, the kind of obsession with sex outside of marriage is confined to very religious fundamentalist Protestants, Orthodox Catholics who are taking their ideas about sexuality from the Vatican, and Orthodox Mormons, and you know some of the charismatic sects that are evangelicals. And that I really do not see this among the general population. I mean, I think there's a wide variety in how people live their personal lives, but I really do think that the vast, vast majority of Americans believe in privacy, personal freedom, pluralism, and tolerance.
But look at how our politics work, and your point is well made that a less than majority group that is deeply committed to resistance to a particular social kind of movement can almost tie the whole country to the tracks. Say, there you lie until we're satisfied that this isn't going to happen.
Okay, so it is because this very small minority has captured the Republican Party, and the reason they've been able to capture the Republican Party has to do with Michael's point, and that is that the, let's just call it the 1%, does not have to live in the world that the theocrats want to create. Because they have their own schools, they have their own doctors. If birth control is illegal, if abortion is legal, they can take care of their daughters. They have their own lines in the airport. Mm-hmm. They have their skyboxes. So I do think that when you lose this common culture, I do think that back in the 70s, the kind of right-wing corporate funders thought that they could play the religious right and that they could control them. And I think now the tail is wagging the dog there, but I think it doesn't matter to the 1%. I mean, it's shocking to me when I hear people on Wall Street who are very socially liberal, have plenty of gay married friends, say that it doesn't matter.
So
that
the religious right controls. To Michael's skyboxification point and to Larry's, if money runs it, money can also buy its way out of the maelstrom that it
alliances the world create. That these people want to create.
To a point. To a point. Michael Sandel, the adoption of this markets first sense, markets will run things. Where did that come from? How did that gain so much power so quickly? I don't remember it as the prevailing ethos of our own youth, which was not so long ago.
Right.
Where did that come from? And what today will be the countervailing force? If the churches that Nancy describes and temples of Mormonism, you name it, are fighting, the stuff she... What's the countervailing force that's going to right the ship?
I think there are two sources, Tom. And It's since we were kids. I agree with you. One source was the explicit argument for markets as the primary instrument for achieving the public good that came in the early 80s with Margaret Thatcher and with Ronald Reagan, an explicit political argument for markets against government.
But you've written that even Margaret Thatcher wouldn't recognize some of the extremes to which this has been taken.
Right. The extent to which it seeped into social life as a whole, neither Reagan nor Thatcher, I think, would have recognized. And I think what powered it in the decades since and made it a cultural motif, not just a political ideology, is that even when they passed from the scene and were replaced by center-left politicians, Tony Blair in Britain, Bill Clinton in the United States, they moderated but consolidated the underlying assumption. They didn't challenge it. The assumption, the market triumphalist faith, if you want to call it that, that markets are the primary instruments for achieving the common good. We have never had a robust public debate about that proposition, even as democratic administrations have replaced Republican ones, likewise in European democracies.
But wasn't, forgive me, but in the 90s, I agree, Bill Clinton triangulated, he kind of embraced it, but in the 80s, wasn't that what the political conversation in the 1980s was all about, whether or not Ronald Reagan was right with his market triumphalism? Wasn't that our conversation then?
For a brief moment, but when he was elected, that became the dispensation, and it really hasn't been challenged since. Barack Obama seemed prepared to challenge it during the 2008 campaign when he articulated a moral and civic idealism that seemed to offer the promise of changing the terms of public discourse. But that was short-lived, and I think the reason it was short-lived is that he took office in the depths of the financial crisis. He felt he was not an expert in Wall Street and the financial world. He gathered about him economic advisors from that world who saw the world through that lens. And partly for that reason, his moral energy, his moral voice was muted for 4 years, and he was not able to translate that moral and civic idealism into governing.
And every time he peeped about it, he was called a socialist, and the country didn't exactly rise up and say, that's ridiculous. It kind of just lingered around him. So what's the counter? If it's not the president, it's not this transformative president of the United States, or once seen as, where's the countervailing force?
Well, the countervailing force actually connects with the second source of this, which is why it was so deeply entrenched, this. I think it has to do, the appeal of markets and market reasoning is not mainly that markets deliver the goods. That's the standard explanation, and we don't want to tinker with that.
Don't mess with that.
Because we've seen the financial crash, all sorts of problems, and that's not really disturbed, this underlying set of attitudes. I think the deeper appeal is that markets and market reasoning and market relations seem to spare us the need to argue together in public about how to value goods and social practices.
We can be atomized at home with a beer and the market will take care of it.
And it seems to be a way of moral neutrality. We don't have to contend with one another in public life about how to value procreation or military service or the environment or health or education. Let each party to the deal place whatever value he or she wants on the goods being exchanged, and we can stand back.
It's kind of a market version of the nanny state. Not the nanny, but the market. The market will take care of it.
Well,
we can roll over.
It's outsourcing moral argument and moral judgment and moral reasoning, we think, to private parties making deals. But what that misses, I think that's the appeal.
Yeah.
What that misses is that if we outsource moral judgment and public decisions to markets, we are not really settling for a neutral decision. Markets will make those decisions for us, and they have. And that's why I think so many people feel disempowered and frustrated with the terms of democratic politics.
Who or what revives the moral and civil discourse? It's bought and paid for. There's, you know, rational ignorance at best. We're all, you know, tangled up in our knickers over gender stuff. not everybody goes to church. Elk lodges are empty. We've got the bowling alone. Where's the magical force that brings back the discourse to challenge that immensely powerful market mythology, if that's what it is?
I don't know if it's a magical force, but there is some hope, I think, in the widespread dissatisfaction and frustration that we see now. People want something better. And I think it's worth pointing out that the turn in our culture that Nancy has described, and the abortion issue in particular in politics, had one very bad effect beyond the ones Nancy has laid out so beautifully. And that is, abortion, the abortion debate, especially as informed by the religious right, came to define, especially for liberals and progressives, what it means to bring moral argument into politics. And that generated an allergy to moral argument in public life. Instead, I think we need to step back and enlarge the terms, the scope of moral argument in politics, to include the economy, to include the questions of markets, to include the role of money, rather than to allow the narrowing, which we've seen during this period, the narrowing of what counts as moral argument in politics to debates about abortion.
Well, I want to come to Philip, but let me just ask you on that then. If the gender issues are so potent, and we know they are, and those who are opposed to change that has come are so committed, can we revive a moral discourse in this country? What's the price of that? Is it Nancy's interest as a woman? Do you have to surrender the abortion issue to make liberals comfortable again with the moral discourse, to open it all up? Is that possible? I mean, that sounds nuts.
Not surrender, to join the issue as a moral argument on the abortion question, but then also to join as a moral argument questions about inequality, justice, the common good, the role of markets, what it means to be a citizen, what are our mutual obligations as citizens. That's the broader terrain of moral argument in politics, not to ignore gender questions and abortion questions, but to enlarge the scope of what it means to reason together, to argue together, knowing that we'll disagree about big moral questions.
If we come to crisis, are women going to be the ones, again, asked to sacrifice their interests so we can all sit at the moral discourse table and figure it out?
No, because I don't think women will allow that to happen. No. But I do think that Michael's point is really apt, because what I talk about is how is the Democratic Party's cowardice about standing up what I call principle, but is really engaging the moral debate on questions of equality, privacy, freedom, to be able to open up these other things. So I think the Democratic Party for many years ran afraid of the mythical middle and said, well, if we just don't talk about it, and, you know, you women, don't talk. You know, we'll take care of you when we get into office.
But they don't need to be afraid anymore, you say.
I do see that the Democrats have finally gotten their spine, and they don't need to be as a matter of, you know, electoral politics.
Because the mainstream has come along,
yes.
In fact.
And I do see the party recognizing today that the public has come along. But we could see another reaction if Obama loses.
Philip Howard, let me come to you. You have this great phrase, a democracy run by dead people. Boy, that's really terrifying. The zombie life. Awesome.
Although then there's the alternative.
The democracy run by living people?
Exactly. Which is better?
But let me ask you, because you described something that sounds really kind of scary, apocalyptic, on your way to the promised land. And that is, if I got you right, what it's going to take to clear this thicket is a major historical event to replace law, to wipe away tens of thousands of pages of law to be thrown out to make way for broad goals and...
No, it's to restore law to what it used to be. The Constitution is barely 15 pages. It prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures in four words. Those four words have been interpreted and applied by authority structures, courts, in a way that enable us to go to bed every night comfortable that generally in our history, that the cops are not going to come in and rifle through our drawers. And so law is incredibly important in a free society, with the rule of law, not men. We've created an anti-human system of law, this kind of the world's worst software program. It's central planning, except the planners are all dead. So they don't even get together every 5 years. I think you go back. I mean, these themes are fantastic. I think the public is smart. I grew up in eastern Kentucky, not known as an intellectual hotbed, where my father was on the borderline of being a fundamentalist preacher.
The Dukes of Hazzard territory.
Absolutely. So these people, if they have ownership of choices, will think about those choices and have a point of view. Michael Sandel's point about the vacuum left that's filled by a market is absolutely right. But it's not just filled by the market, it's filled by lunatics of the right and to a certain extent on the left who fill that vacuum with their values while we are disempowered and told that everything's going to be neutral and fine and fair, and we surrender to forms and bureaucracies and neutral hearings, things where we see abuses of it every day, where the bad teacher can't get fired, where the good project can't get approved for 8 years, you know, all these sort of idiocies of modern life. People don't, everyone in the country knows that the political dialogue is phony. That's why they've tuned out. The polls show that. It's phony.
But here we are, and forgive me, and maybe I'm watching too many dystopic movies, but I really want to...
We need a new narrative.
How we get to that. Because you're talking about, you're counting on a major historical event to sweep aside tens of thousands of lost. Like, what are you envisioning? Who's the spaceship pilot?
Nothing.
What is it?
Nothing is politically feasible today. They can't even extend the budget ceiling.
Well, that's what I mean. So what are you picturing as this event?
So what the political scientists say is that change comes like the stick slip phenomenon of earthquakes. You go back to the 1960s, period of change. You go back to the New Deal, period of change. Progressive era. These were big changes in moral values. We changed our values in those periods. We need a change in values, but I believe the change in values and the narrative, which I think includes everything that everybody's talked about today, also includes a meta value, which is how things get done.
Mm-hmm. And, we just had a fiscal financial crisis, and that didn't do it. So what kind of stick, slip, tectonic shift? People get hurt in earthquakes.
We're getting there.
On this, if we look at this presidential campaign, there were two moments when when the candidates almost committed some genuine political philosophy. And those moments...
Heaven help us.
Those moments were the two famous gaffes. A wise observer once said that a gaffe in Washington is when a politician inadvertently says what he really believes.
Yeah. Can't stand that.
The two famous gaffes were Romney's 47%, and when he said all these people believe they're entitled to a government doing everything for them. That was one. And for Obama's part, it's when he said, if you started a business, you didn't build it.
Isn't that a misquote? You don't think it was a misquote?
Well, he was trying, not artfully, but he was trying to articulate an idea. So was Romney in that videotape thing. The idea that was buried, but where we could catch a glimmer of it in the Romney secret video on the 47% was a certain idea of individual freedom, that the welfare state is actually illegitimate because people are not entitled to benefit from the proceeds of those who are successful. There's a germ of an actual idea there about freedom. Not one I agree with, but it's an argument that could be made. And for Obama's part, what he was trying not too successfully to articulate was an idea of community.
Yes.
That we are all in this together. And even those who succeed, those of us who succeed, are not morally entitled to the full fruits that the market bestows on our success.
Yes.
But we are indebted in all sorts of ways as members of a political community with mutual obligations to one another. So buried, but almost visible in those two famous gaffes, were a certain idea of freedom that underlies the Republican attack on the welfare state, and a certain idea of community that somewhere is rumbling around beneath the surface of Barack Obama's politics. But because they were simply seen as gas, they were quickly buried, and no political philosophy has raised its ugly head since.
But we heard them, and we saw them. The hour's late. Our time grows short. The gloom gathers. Randy, let me come to you this way. Let's have our little seance here, and we can't do a slow one. I'm sorry for that. But I want to ask each of you, because I want to go out of here focused on hope, as otherwise, what's the point? So what is it? And I'll come, Philip, first to you. What do we need to summon, in brief, from our past? What do we need to summon in the future to break the problem you see, to get to that better path?
I think we need a new public narrative. I think everyone has to get involved in it. We have to look around to people here, to others, put pressure on the political system in the way Larry's described. But it's not just getting rid of the worst abuses of the system. Our society is not allowing people in their daily lives to make the kind of moral choices they need to make their daily lives moral. And it just ripples all the way up into even worse in our political system. So I think we need to recognize the fact that we're coming up to a time of big change where we need choices, where we need people who act on their sense of right and wrong, not pursuant to some legal program, you know, that's taken away everyone's personal authority.
Michael Sandel, go deep. What would you summon from our past, from in our future, to address this moment, our challenge?
To change our primary identities as consumers back to that of citizens. We think of freedom. Freedom is...
Amen.
Freedom is the Central American political value. It's our touchstone. But what's happened is today we've come to think of freedom as consumerist freedom, the freedom to buy and sell goods together, rather than the freedom of citizens to argue with one another, to deliberate together about the common good, and to ask more from one another as citizens with mutual obligations.
Nancy Cohen, our better angels, what would you summon, past, future?
I'm not going deep, I'm going simple. Vote, vote, vote. Stay engaged after the election. Encourage other people to stay engaged. Sane Republicans, take back your party. If we do this, the delirium about these gender and sex issues will end, and we can deal with all of these real fundamental questions about citizenship and money dominating politics and global warming, etc.
That call itself a kind of vote of confidence in our democracy. Vote, vote, vote,
yes.
And it will work out. Randall Kennedy, what would you summon?
I was in Washington, D.C. at the inauguration of President Obama. It was an absolutely extraordinary moment. And I think it may have been one of those real big misses. You know, when we look back, it seems that progress was inevitable, but sometimes there is a possibility and it's missed.
The inauguration was a miss, or the first term?
The presidency.
I think that there was, you know, yes, there was a crisis. Yes, people wanted something. Yes, there was yearning. Yes, there was enthusiasm. Yes, there was lots of possibility. And I think that for various reasons, that possibility wasn't tapped. And we end up 4 years later in a rather miserable state when, at least for me, the most I'm hoping for is relief and not exaltation. 4 years ago...
Pepto-Bismol is all we can summon here?
They think you mean Romney. You better.
I do not mean Romney. I mean relief from. I was there as a Obama supporter. Mm-hmm. I am still an Obama supporter. But 4 years ago, I think there were lots of people, including, by the way, people who did not vote for Obama.
If he gets another at bat.
Yeah.
What would you whisper in his ear? What should he summon in this country to do better if it was a whiff?
I would say reread your most idealistic speeches. Look hard at those masses of people that were in front of you, beseeching you for, you know, a different way, and go for it.
Lawrence Lessig, summon. This is a hall that takes this seriously. We are a people, despite our ignorance and our not showing up at the polls, I still believe, who want this country to address the enormous challenges of this century. We want to apply our highest ideals. We do not want to be bound up in red tape and law or consumerism or old gender traps or failures of leadership. So what do we summon?
Yeah, so it's a wonderful and romantic idea to imagine the leader standing up and leading us.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so I think we've seen that, and it hasn't worked, right? So Michael says we've got to revive the sense of citizen. What is a citizen? A citizen is the person, all of us, the people, who recognize that at certain times we have to exercise this unalienable right given to us to stand up and take back this power and reclaim it and reform it.
Amen. Okay.
So they won't talk about these issues. We've got to find a way to revive it. There is a giant in the room. It's us. And that giant slowly wakes up. And it takes lots of us to be able to learn to talk to people very different from us, talk across a political divide, talk to left, to right. And I think we can do what we have done two times in our history before, to wake up and to take this challenge on. So that's what we have to do.
Wake up. We've come to the end of our short time here today. It's been great to have such a wonderful crowd. Please let this gang head out. Lawrence Lessig,
I think the progressive era, and I think founding era.
I'm Tom.
I think the war, the Civil War,
thank you very much for coming.
A different kind of wake up. It was violence.